Augustinian theology was not immediately accepted in the church. Let's be frank about that. As controversies arose, Augustine's theology was commonly seen in disputing many ecclesiastical heresies. Grace and predestination have always been difficult to hurdle and overcome, since most people do not like the idea that God is in control of everything, including the will of men and their eternal destinies. For Augustine, grace is completely unmerited, and it can't be earned. John Cassian, who wrote against Pelagianism, also attempted to steer far and wide away from Augustine's extreme views. Vincent of Lerins' attack on Augustinianism were far more vicious. He thought Augustine was an innovator of these ideas and that they must be rejected as innovation that has no place in the faith of the Catholic Church, Catholic meaning universal. Faustus of Reims was the most ardent of the anti-Augustinians. He defended human freedom and free will in his work on the grace of God and free will. Against these attacks, Augustine and his disciples wrote vigorously for the truth of the gospel. These other forms were simply semi-Pelagian ideas, and we will talk about what that means in a few lessons ahead, because we'll be dealing with certain aspects of a kind of a restating in a new fashion Pelagius' theology without going to the extreme of Pelagius' theology. By 529 AD, at the Synod of Orange, semi-Pelagianism was eradicated and condemned as well, and Augustinianism was upheld as the biblical and exegetical true position. Other controversies emerged as the dispute over the nature of the soul came about. Augustine said that the soul was incorporeal. In saying this, he was abandoning what Tertullian had said. Also, Boethius brought up the question of universals, which had a great impact on medieval philosophy. His best-known treatise is The Consolation of Philosophy, which he used terms like person, substance, being, and other ideas surrounding Trinitarian doctrine. He also highlighted what course logic would take in medieval thinking. Cassador was a contemporary of Boethius, and he wrote to uphold Augustine's ideas surrounding the soul. Gregory the Great served as a filter to some of the medieval theologians. He was widely read by them and worked in Augustine's theology in all of his writing. In this way, he acted as a filter for Augustinianism and Augustinian thought to those who read him. However, he abandoned sovereign grace for a more semi-Pelagian theology. Benedict of Nursia, he wrote on the monastic life and became very influential to medieval thinking in this area. And the same may be said of Martin of Braga. Isidore of Seville was not theologically original, but his work, Etymologies, was encyclopedic, and most medieval thinkers quoted him in their own writings. This was a manual of universal knowledge that extended and touched on everything from grammar to theology. So that was basically some of the Western theology that came up after Augustine. Well, Eastern theology, between the 4th and the 6th ecumenical councils, we find, obviously, many Christological controversies continuing throughout the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries. Unfortunately, the definition of faith of Chalcedon did not put an end to these controversies in the East. Most were upset with the idea of the formula into natures concerning Christ. Severus's work was the most popular of the day and affirmed the true and total humanity of Christ as well as his true and total divinity, but insists that these are united in a single nature, which means that there are really three natures to speak of, according to him. Some of the emperors attempted to bring the church back to the councils and their definitions, because these other people kept popping up, but the East and the West had too many differences in the manner in which they conceived the idea of the hypostasis and the nature of Christ. As a result, schism. Schism is always the result of things like this. The tension came about, the schism of Axius took place from 484 to 519 AD, and this schism lasted until the principal players at the time died off. Emperor Justin, after this time, reinstated unity between the East and the West. After Justin died, his son, Justinian took the throne and desired to heal the wound of the previous split completely. He held a council in Constantinople known as the Fifth Ecumenical Council, and there the teachings of the Monophysites were condemned along with Theodore of Mopsuestia. At the Sixth Ecumenical Council in 681 AD, the issue around nature and substance was finally put to rest, affirming the theology that taught the two natures were united in one person in Jesus Christ. Now, a number of different writings and individuals attempted to gain ground during this time. Among them were Dionysius, who wrote Pseudo-Dionysius, a blatantly Neoplatonic writing. Another, Leontius of Byzantium, who was an outstanding theologian under Justinian's reign, he wrote about the hypostasis and the essence in an orthodox light against Nestorius. He taught that the main difference between the essence or nature on the one hand and the hypostasis on the other is that the essence is that which makes a thing belong to a genus, whereas hypostasis is what gives it its individuality. These two natures come together, and they don't lose their properties. They are simply joined together. Maximus the Confessor, who was a proponent who argued against monotheism, that there was one principal energy or one person in Christ. Instead, he believed there were two principal energies or two persons. There must be the human natural will and the divine natural will in the two natures respectively. Here, the stage is set for the development and further development of the Nestorian heresy. Now, the Nestorius heresy had been condemned at Ephesus in 433 AD. There was no room left for compromise on the issue. However, political ramifications kept the theology alive for a time, so it did propagate a bit. The first theologian for the Nestorians, besides Nestorius himself, was Narses. His main Christological formula was two natures, two hypostases, and one appearance or presence. Basically, he modified the teaching of Theodore of Mopsuestia, and this gave birth to the term monophysism, which was simply a rejection of the Chalcedonian Creed.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com. By phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's E-D-M-O-N-T-O-N, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart, from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, I have not commanded them whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying His word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important when he says that God had commanded no such thing and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.